Malone Broadcast Center. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Democratic presidential candidates were making their pitch to the California wing of the party this weekend. We'll hear about who was there, what was said, and why a comment by Barack Obama was an elephant in the convention room. Plus, why the LAPD Hate Crimes Unit wants you to be informed on what exactly a hate crime is and is not. That and a lot more coming up when Take Two kicks off in just a few. Keep your ears here. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for starting your week off with us. All right, coming up, more than two-thirds of the state has been declared abnormally dry by the U.S. Drought Monitor. We'll find out what's going on there. Plus, we go to Highland Park, where musicians young and old are coming together to jam. It's the community band.
My name is Christy Rodehorst, and I'm 79, and I play the flute. I'm 50 years older than most of them, and we all get along, and it's pretty special.
Stick around for that at the end of the show. We start, though, with an eye on politics. Now, sure, Iowa, New Hampshire get most of the attention these days, but no one puts L.A. in a corner, especially now that our solidly blue state moved its primary to March. For a couple of days this past weekend, the presidential race moved to Southern California. At least a dozen Democratic candidates were in Long Beach for the California Democrats' fall nominating convention. And KPCC's senior politics reporter Libby Dankman covered all of it. Hello, Libby.
Hi, A.
Dirty Dancing was on this weekend, too, by the way.
I was watching a lot of clips, if you can't tell by that lead.
I know. I'm glad you were. All right, so what happened? Who was in town and where were they?
Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg. I mean, you name them, they were in town, except for two major exceptions that we'll talk about in just a second. Cory Booker, Julian Castro, Andrew Yang. I mean, the list goes on. They were holding these parties and rallies for their supporters around town. Harris spoke at a drag bar at Hamburger Mary's in Long Beach, and I recorded a little bit of her firing up supporters.
We need somebody who is the Democratic nominee for President of the United States who has the ability to go toe-to-toe with Donald Trump, and you're looking at her.
Sanders had a rally with the band Ozomatli at a high school in El Sereno. The convention itself was really full of these super engaged delegates and activists. They're wearing T-shirts, buttons, hats with their political slogans, that kind of a thing. They're meeting in caucus rooms, adopting new party rules, and they're endorsing down-ballot candidates, especially for Assembly and State Senate. Congressman Adam Schiff really delivered a barn burner of a speech. The crowd went crazy for him. He was coming off those impeachment hearings last week. The marquee event, though, is seeing people running for the Democratic nomination for president. Eight of those candidates appeared on a Univision forum on Saturday. Five of them were back at Cal State LA the next day. And that conversation really focused on Latino issues. One campaign manager, A, called the weekend essentially a music festival for Democrats.
Okay, but if it's a music festival, then two of the biggest acts weren't even there, Warren and Biden.
Yeah, Biden held a rally in L.A. at L.A. Trade Technical College on Thursday, but then he left town without speaking to the delegates, which seemed like a clear snub, and Rusty Hicks, the party chair of the state party, said so. We talked last week about how Biden may have been trying to avoid possible unfriendly crowd response, boos, that kind of a thing, because these are very progressive delegates at this convention. A lot of activists were very disappointed about Elizabeth Warren not showing up, but she's getting a pass. She's been in the state quite a bit lately.
All right. Now, you said the candidates were focused on issues Latino voters cared about. So what were some of those issues?
It really ranged from immigration to health care, the economy. These are issues very important to not just Latino voters. Everybody else also cares about these issues. But this was just a couple of days after the Supreme Court heard oral arguments on ending DACA. So immigration was a big topic. All the Democrats running for president vowed to restore safeguards for DACA recipients and extend protections to their parents as well. Univision's Jorge Ramos pressed both Kamala Harris and Bernie Sanders to reckon with President Obama's record of deporting millions of immigrants. And unlike Biden, who kind of stumbled on this in an earlier debate question, Bernie had a simple answer.
Would you say that he made a mistake by deporting 3 million people?
Yes.
All right. Now, no mincing of words here, Libby. We just experienced a horrible school shooting here in Southern California, Saugus High School, on Thursday. And naturally, the issue of gun violence loomed over the convention. What did you hear on that?
Nearly everyone favored tighter background checks and a ban on assault weapons. Others had further proposals. Cory Booker wants gun licenses, for example. Some favor gun buybacks. The conversation got off to a really emotional start when Kamala Harris took a question from a Saugus High School student who spoke of her terror during the attack last week. This student asked what Harris would do to keep students safe from the fear of being shot at school. And Harris walked over, put her hand on the girl's shoulder, and she promised to take executive action as president to tighten restrictions on gun purchases if Congress does not act within her first 100 days in office. But it's not clear if that is constitutional, and none of the candidates had a great answer for how to get a divided Congress to act on issues like this or immigration reform.
Now, you mentioned health care. That debate over Medicare for all has been a huge fault line with Democrats.
It is the divide in the Democratic Party right now between progressives who want a more revolutionary change in the healthcare system, getting rid of private insurance, and moderates who say that they want change, but it needs to happen more slowly. And South Bend, Indiana Mayor Pete Buttigieg waded right into the deep end on Saturday, especially in front of this activist crowd. He explained his reasoning for supporting a public option, at least at first, instead of a more progressive single-payer plan.
If this is the best plan for everybody, then everybody will choose it, and it will become the single payer. If, on the other hand, there remain some Americans, I'm thinking, for example, about a lot of union members who negotiated good private plans, who would prefer to keep their plan, I'm not going to command them to abandon that plan.
And you heard that cheer when he mentioned the unions, which are, of course, a classic part of the base for the Democratic Party. Unlike a lot of moderate candidates who spoke about the public option instead of single payer, Mayor Pete wasn't getting booed in that crowd.
Now, we're talking about the candidates. What about the crowd? I mean, who are these California Party activists backing in this presidential race so far?
I'll tell you what. I did see a lot of Buttigieg T-shirts, Harris signs. The Yang Gang was there. Signs for Marianne Williamson. Oh, yeah, they show up. Some Elizabeth Warren and Joe Biden folks, even though they're people were not in town, they're candidates. Polling has shown a real three-way race in California. Warren, Biden, and Sanders are at the top of the heap. But one name stuck out with these activists in Long Beach. Theo Bernie. That Sanders nickname with Spanish-speaking fans.
Theo means uncle, by the way.
Yes, Uncle Bernie. Or I guess it's kind of like, can also be a family friend. Am I correct on that?
I guess, yeah. I don't call my uncle my family friend. He's my Theo.
Sure. The delegates saved their loudest cheers for Bernie Sanders. You saw his signs and slogans everywhere. I mean, he was the big star of the day. His supporters have been working their way into this state party machine since 2016, since he lost to Hillary Clinton here, and they've been investing big in this state. The Sanders team has 40 full-time staffers here. They've opened another field office in San Francisco recently.
One more thing, Libby, President Obama made some not so thinly veiled remarks about two presidential hopefuls on Friday. He was speaking at an event for Democratic donors. He warned the candidates not to lean too far left. Now, those words are facing a lot of pushback online. What response did you hear to that?
This convention crowd, again, is further left than the average Democratic voter, so that sentiment was definitely not popular in Long Beach over the weekend. The idea that Democrats need a moderate alternative to Joe Biden, who has fumbled some questions and is making some party activists and donors nervous, it's probably why you see former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick join the race at this late stage, and former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, another possible late entrant. But the crowd did not sound excited about Deval Patrick when he spoke on Saturday morning. They sound like they're pretty happy with their choices.
That's KPCC political reporter Thea Libby Denkman talking about the California Democrats fall nominating convention. Your friend.
Yes.
We're all friends here.
We are.
Libby, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Turning now to housing, a new state law takes effect in January that's aimed at strengthening legal protections for renters. Now, in the meantime, though, landlords are seeking to evict thousands of tenants around California now before that happens. And that has more than two dozen cities around the state rushing to approve emergency eviction moratoriums in their own jurisdictions. With us to talk more about it is KPCC's housing reporter, Matt Tinoco. Welcome back, Matt.
Hi.
All right, so can you tell us a little bit more about the state law that's expanding tenant protections? What exactly does it do?
Long story short, it protects tenants who live in apartment buildings that were built more than 15 years ago or who live in rented single-family homes that are owned by a corporate landlord from evictions and rent gouging. So the authors estimate that it affects about 8 million individual Californians.
Ooh, big number, yeah.
It's not 8 million households, though. Yeah. It's 8 million individuals who live in renting households. And basically what the bill does is it caps rent increases to 5% plus change the consumer price index each year. Practically speaking, that's about 8% a year. And then it also eliminates what's called no-fault evictions.
And what's that, no-fault evictions?
It's pretty much exactly what it sounds like. So in the state of California, landlords have historically been allowed to terminate a tenancy that's on a month-to-month lease simply by serving the person who lives in that unit with a 30 to 60-day notice to vacate their unit. And that's an eviction. It's not tied to any specific reason like a lease violation or something. It's just for or with no fault. The new state law says that a tenant can only be evicted for cause. So that's something like violating their lease or not paying rent, damaging the property, or engaging in criminal activity. So people under the new state law can still be evicted, but it just can't happen at the whim of an owner, as has been the sort of status quo until now.
Now, Matt, we've heard reports that this type of eviction has surged lately, recent months. What's the explanation for the surge?
Because it's still legal to do so right now. So AB 1482, that's the bill number for the state law, it didn't get the two-thirds majority needed to become effective right away. It just barely got a simple majority. Mm-hmm. So instead, the law becomes effective on January 1st, 2020. In the days just after Governor Gavin Newsom announced the compromise that led to this bill happening, it wasn't ever a sure thing that the bill would actually make it through the state legislature. Right. But just after the compromise got announced, you had some landlord attorneys advising their clients that if they wanted to earn more money, they should evict their poor tenants before the new law goes into effect on January 1st of 2020, because it'll be harder to get them out after January 1, 2020. So like I said, you need to give, for no-fault evictions, you need to give 30 to 60 days notice to get somebody out. But the law was signed 85 days before it goes into effect.
All right, so I get why they would want to evict tenants, but what would be the incentive? I mean, aren't they losing money on rent in the short term?
Yeah. In the short term, yes, you're right. The surge of evictions that are happening now are largely in low-income buildings that were presumably purchased for some future return on investment. So owners, when they purchase one of these buildings, have long-term investment plans. And in many cases, the current tenants, the people living in the buildings, when they made that investment, were not a part of their long-term investment plan. So maybe they're planning on rehabbing the building and leasing the apartments to more well-off tenants for higher rents at some point in the future, but they weren't planning on doing it just yet. However, now the fact that they might be prohibited from doing that in the near future just accelerated the timeline, meaning the eviction notices happen now instead of sometime down the line. Though, I mean, for what it's worth, the State Apartment Association is discouraging owners from doing just this too.
Now, how are cities responding to this apparent wave of evictions?
They're passing a bunch of laws that say, in essence, just no-fault evictions in our jurisdiction until the state law kicks in. It's a very stopgap approach. Mm-hmm. Like you said in the lead, it's about two dozen cities statewide have done this. Locally, the city of LA, I believe, was the very first one. But you also have like Long Beach, Pasadena, South Pass, Alhambra, Bell Gardens, Torrance, Pomona, and a number of other cities have also passed these rules that just say no-fault evictions until January 1. Then you also have a couple of cities like Burbank and Santa Ana, notably, that have declined to pass such a rule because they say it would be unfair for property owners.
Two more quick things. Are the rules going to work, and are they even legal?
So are they legal? We believe they are, but people are concerned that maybe they aren't. We have to wait and see until somebody challenges it, which to my knowledge has not happened yet, but that is a worry among cities that are passing them. That, however, has not stopped a bunch of cities from passing them. As far as where they work, we're only just is now getting to the point where notices to vacate that were filed back in September are running their term because, like I said, you need 30 to 60 days. So the question of whether or not the eviction protection rules themselves work is going to be answered within the next month and a half. Though, for what it's worth, I actually contacted an LA County Superior Court judge, and he did confirm to me that the LA City rules were used to prevent at least one eviction in the city of LA so far. So that is it worked for that one person so far.
All right, that's KPCC housing reporter Matt Tinoco. Matt, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
All right, now to our democracy. On KPCC this month, familiar voices are reading the amendments to the Constitution, like Norman Lear on the First Amendment, Roxane Gay on a citizen's right to vote. Plus, there's Shepard Fairey, Danny Trejo, and many, many more. It's part of the nationwide Purple Project for Democracy, a nonpartisan campaign to recommit to democratic values and institutions. Here is today's installment.
I'm LeVar Burton. Your public radio station is celebrating American democracy by presenting the amendments to the U.S. Constitution that lay out our freedoms and how democracy works. The 13th Amendment was ratified on December 6, 1865. Neither slavery nor involuntary servitude, except as a punishment for crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted, shall exist within the United States, or any place subject to their jurisdiction. And then came the 15th Amendment, 5 years later. The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. These two amendments together are the passport, the entry point to my rights as a citizen of the United States, and the rights of people who look like me. I feel like my family and countless others have earned our place in America through blood, sweat, tears, and, as it says in the Constitution, this condition of servitude that was so unjustly vested upon our people.
That's actor LeVar Burton reading the 15th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. It's part of the nationwide campaign Purple Project for Democracy. All right, coming up, the LAPD Hate Crimes Unit wants you to be informed on how to define a hate crime. Now, one way is to be in the know on who is committing them.
It isn't hate groups that are doing this. It is single incidents, one-on-one, with two-thirds of our suspects being of minority descent. So it's blacks against Hispanics, Hispanics against Asians, whites against blacks. It's a mixture of everything.
Hear all about it when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Well, the number of hate crimes across the nation declined slightly last year. Violence against individuals reached a 16-year high. Now, that's according to data recently released by the FBI. A total of 7,120 hate crimes were reported in 2018, and the majority of those incidents, nearly 60%, were motivated by race and ethnicity bias. Now, with that, we wanted to hear about what's happening locally. Here in Los Angeles, there was a 13% increase in 2018, the highest in a decade, according to a recent report by the Center for Study of Hate and Extremism. Now, to explain that uptick and what's being done to curb those numbers, here is Detective Orlando Martinez, the hate crime coordinator for the Los Angeles Police Department. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, when it comes to hate crime in LA the past 10 years, what's your team witness when it comes to increases there?
I go to community meetings, and one of the things that I ask is how many people in here have been the victim of or know someone who has been the victim of a hate crime. Usually 3/4 of the place will raise their hand. So last year, the Los Angeles Police Department responded to about 400,000 radio calls, not including tickets, not including observation stops, just radio calls. Out of those 400,000, there were 290 that were hate crimes in the city of LA.
Out of 400,000.
Right. So statistically, very improbable. But it isn't hate groups that are doing this. It is single incidents, one-on-one, with 2/3 of our suspects being of minority descent. So it's blacks against Hispanics, Hispanics against Asians, whites against blacks. It's a mixture of everything.
The bias motivation for hate crimes in Los Angeles were largely anti-black, anti-gay, anti-Jewish, anti-Hispanic or Latino, and anti-transgender. Why is this happening? What could be motivating these increases in these incidents? Why are people committing these crimes?
We don't know the cause of it, but we do know, as with other crimes, if it is normalized, more people will think it's okay to do it. One of the things that you mentioned, the anti-trans crimes, the numbers aren't as high as the rest, but when it comes to trans crimes, the most common crime against them are aggravated assaults. When it comes to the bias of religion, the most common crime is vandalisms. So depending on the group that is being attacked, there's different types of crimes that are more common for those victims. And that just worries the community when they think that this is going on in my neighborhood. And sometimes they think that we're not doing anything about it, we as the police.
In a way that makes sense, though, Detective, when it comes to, say, the religious part of it, when it comes to vandalism, because the crime would be against a symbol. And a lot of times a church of any kind or a synagogue is a symbol of a group of people. When it comes to trans, you know, trans people, what do they have as a symbol other than maybe themselves? So the attack is on the person. So in a way, in a weird way, it kind of makes sense.
Right. And so trying to be proactive as a police department, you know, trying to find effective ways to educate and to combat this is very difficult. Realistically, there's so many targets that it is impossible to harden up or guard all of them. So you have to do your best to educate the institutions themselves to help themselves out. Same thing with to educate the public what to do if they're the victim of a hate crime, because if they don't report it, there's nothing we can do. There's no way we're going to catch the suspect if we don't know about it.
We're talking to Detective Orlando Martinez, hate crime coordinator for the LAPD. Now, Detective, you mentioned how crimes like this are typically underreported, but walk us through that process. How does the LAPD manage reported hate crimes?
So the LAPD has 4 levels of review to see whether a crime should be classified as a hate crime. So you have the initial officers that go there. They meet with the victim, and the victim may not even know that it's a hate crime. There are forms that the officers carry and refer to that help them make this judgment on the elements of what crime has occurred. Then after that, you have the supervisor who reviews the report. Then it goes to our records department. They disseminate all the copies. And then after that, we have crime analysts at each division. And then on top of that, I get a copy of every one, review it, and ensure that the previous steps have been followed.
Wondering if someone comes and reports what they believe to be a hate crime, but once it starts going through the layered process, it's kind of determined that it's not. How often does that happen?
So that happens quite a lot. So if something happens where 2 people get into an argument and slurs are thrown, very offensive speech, it is not a crime. However, we still encourage people to report that, because at the Los Angeles Police Department, we take a hate incident report. So if they start out small and eventually get where they do commit a hate crime, we will have these other documented incidents.
It's the paper trail.
To
right?
use against
yeah.
them.
Yeah.
Yes.
What's being done then maybe to prevent these crimes from happening altogether as opposed to responding after the fact?
Well, that's a tough one. It's very difficult to be proactive. Most of them are heat of the moment type things. How do you prevent that other than high visibility? So we're trying to go through the educating the public on what their options are, partnering with advocacy groups and institutions that can help them after the fact. But it's very difficult to come up with effective ways to stop it.
You have one tough job. That's Detective Orlando Martinez, hate crime coordinator for the LAPD. Detective, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
After declaring California drought-free earlier this year, it's starting to creep back in and around certain regions in the southeast, and more than two-thirds of the state is now considered abnormally dry. For a little context, back in March, less than 7% of the state was characterized as so. The U.S. Drought Monitor put out its latest report on all of this last week, but to get a little more insight into what it all means, we called up Jay Lund, director of the Center for Watershed Science at UC Davis. Welcome back, Jay.
Happy to be here.
All right. Now, what does abnormally dry mean?
Well, for Northern California, which is where most of the precipitation falls in the state, we are probably at about the driest year on record so far. But we're still very, very early in the wet season.
Driest year on record. But when it comes to actually abnormally dry, I mean, is it something that's just
abnormally dry?
Okay, so that's what it means then. Okay, now about this time last year, we were at the beginning of storm after storm after storm. It seems so much precipitation came down that it was a boon to things like the snowpack. I mean, how big of a shift is this now, Jay?
I don't think it's too much of a shift yet. Last November was unusually wet. This one is unusually dry. California is unusually variable, even historically. Certainly with climate change, it's projected to become even more variable than it has been in the past.
Any read as to why we're seeing this now? Anything in particular that's going on?
Not being a climatologist, I don't know really why, but it is abnormally dry.
Now,
we'll noticed.
Now, what would happen? What would have to happen or not for us to go from abnormally dry conditions into an actual drought, full-fledged drought?
Well, drought is a little bit in the eyes of the beholder, but I think we probably have a year or so to go before we'd really be into a drought. This year still has quite a few months of wet season to go, and we're still not yet in the wettest months of the wet season, December, January, February, March. So we still could have a very wet year, but so far we're unusually dry. There's not a lot of correlation between the early months of the wet season and how wet the water year is overall. So I'm not pessimistic yet. We are starting off with most of the large reservoirs being a little bit above average in terms of storage. Many of the groundwater basins in the state have recovered considerably from where they were during the depths of the drought, except, I think, for parts of the Tulare Basin. So we could be in a lot worse shape. I think it's too early to get ready for a drought just yet. But we should always be ready for a drought in California.
So these reserves, these reservoirs, groundwater sources, are they full or mostly full? I mean,
This time of year, we're trying to draw them down a little bit to make room for floods.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you get a flood and it's always a little bit of a balance. How much do you want to expose yourself to floods versus droughts? Floods can be pretty bad in much of the state. So at this time of the year, we're tending to draw the reservoirs down a bit to make room for floods. But so far, they're not drawn down into the normal flood storage range.
So they're in a space right now where we are still controlling things, at least as much as we could on nature.
Yeah, I think we're in sort of a normal kind of condition where. We've had a couple of dry months, even though I think this has been extraordinarily dry for the first 2 months. But it's not like we haven't had drier periods like this and come back out of a fairly wet.
Talking to Jay Lund, director of the Center for Watershed Science at UC Davis. Jay, what would be ideal in the next few months in terms of rain, in terms of just what would keep us, at least in a situation where we're not fearing for a lot of damage and danger?
I don't think we need to fear too much just yet. I think we always need to be cautious in California for both extremes. Ideally, we'd get a lot of very cold storms come in and give us lots of snowpack, sort of like what we had last year.
Because we've had two rainy winters, wondering if a third, just like we've had the last two, would be helpful or hurtful at this point?
I think it would be helpful, as long as they're not floods.
Yeah.
Because we'll catch, particularly if they come in as cold storms, we'll keep that snowpack around for a while, and we'll be able to use that to recharge more of the groundwater basins in some of the parts of the state where they're still pretty well drawn down.
Now, Jay, I know heading into this weekend, at least in the L.A. area, we were all kind of bracing ourselves because we were hearing how dry it was and the winds were picking up and it was going to be hot. And we seems like we got out of this weekend at least okay. What are the concerns for wildfires in the state if we don't get more regular precipitation?
I think from a perspective of wildfires, I'd like to see a rainstorm real fast pretty much everywhere in the state. It's that first rainstorm that really helps suppress the wildfires. So that can't happen soon enough for me and probably most other people in the state.
All right. Jay Lund, director of the Center for Watershed Science at UC Davis. Jay, thanks a lot.
You're very welcome. Bye.
All right, there's a community in the Coachella Valley called Thermal. Around 3,000 people live there, 99% of which are Latino, a third of which live below the poverty line. Now, a fire has been burning there for about a month now, less than a mile from a school at a recycling facility, one of the many fires at that very site in just the past year. And the lack of action has many of the residents of Thermal and Coachella Valley claiming environmental racism. Find out what that is when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The Martinez Fire in the Coachella Valley has been burning for over a month now. Officials say that they're close to putting it out, but locals are feeling frustrated with a slow response, pointing to, quote, environmental racism, end quote, as a contributing factor to the delay. To discuss what's been going on, we have reporter Ricardo Lopez, who has been covering this for the Desert Sun. Ricardo, welcome.
Thank you.
Give us a recap of the Martinez fire. What happened and why is it taking so long to put out?
So the Martinez fire started October 14th and has been burning for nearly a month now. Fire officials are pretty close to extinguishing it here fully in the next coming days. But it's one of several fires that have occurred here at the Sun Valley Recycling Center in Thermal, which sits on tribal lands in an unincorporated area of Riverside County. And it's a dump that's been operating illegally. It never secured the necessary business licenses from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And for the past 2-3 years, there have been a number of recurring fires there that have caused a lot of smoke in the air and affected the air quality there.
So if it's a fire, why can't someone just go put it out?
So it's a very unique type of fire. So it's a green waste recycling facility. There are mulch piles which consist of discarded lawn clippings that are about 12 to 15 feet tall, and the green waste is actually pretty flammable. And so firefighters have been using specialized equipment like bulldozers and water tenders to kind of move the mulch piles around and extinguish these hot spots and keep them from igniting. So it's pretty slow, tedious work that's been occurring there for the past few weeks.
Is there clarity on which agency has oversight over this facility in terms of putting the fire out?
It's been difficult for officials to sort out. In fact, a colleague of mine last week reported some of the jurisdictional confusion that existed between Cal Fire and the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Initially, when the fire started, Cal Fire was the first agency to respond, but then the incident was turned over to the Bureau of Indian Affairs to manage. And so there was questions over who was leading the investigation to the cause of the fire. And I think now they've determined that the Bureau of Indian Affairs is investigating the cause of the fire, which they suspect to be arson.
Oh, okay. So, but you said that a few more days, and people are pretty convinced that this particular fire will be out in a few days.
Correct. They're, the firefighters are installing a type of agricultural fire sprinkler system to help put out the hot spots and make sure that they're completely out.
Talking about the Martinez fire in the Coachella Valley with reporter Ricardo Lopez covering this for the Desert Sun. Okay, now to the residents out there in Thermal near where the fire is burning. They've complained about air quality. They felt sick soon after the fire started. Tell us a little bit about that and how they're feeling right now.
Sure. So Thermal is an area of the valley here where more than a third of the residents live below the poverty line, and more than 99% are Latino. It consists primarily of a lot of farm workers who live in mobile home parks. Some of them have unpaved roads. And so for the past month, they've been feeling that the slow response that they feel has been affecting them is partly due to the fact that they feel sort of largely out of sight, out of mind. And they feel that officials could have, you know, put together the resources more quickly to put out the fire.
Is the thought, Ricardo, that if this were Palm Springs, this fire would have been out a long time ago?
Correct. A lot of the students who I spoke with at nearby Desert Mirage High School, and there's also two more schools on that same campus. There's a middle school and an elementary school. So in total, nearly 4,000 students, teachers, and staff. And so the thought is, if a fire like this had been happening near Palm Springs, there's no way that they would have let it burn for so long, nor would they have kept kids in school for the first 4 days of the fire.
And this is where some people are throwing the term environmental racism around. What is that, and how is it being used in this situation?
So it's a term popularized in the 1980s to refer to the environmental injustices that tend to afflict communities of color, low-income communities. I think some folks refer to it to, you know, the environmental justice movement. You know, for folks here, the thought is, you know, they have to go through so many different layers of bureaucracy here to get some help. But also, you know, they don't really have a city council to which they can turn to, like in neighboring La Quinta when they had a situation with another green waste facility that was emitting an odor that was wafting over to this golf course community of Trilogy. You know, they much better funded effort there to shut it down. And even when the county shut down that facility, the timeline they felt was not aggressive enough initially, and so they were able to get that facility shuttered much more quickly.
And also the lack of communication, too, is what I'm hearing that residents are concerned about. So it sounds, Ricardo, like the residents there could be justified in thinking that there is some kind of wealth gap in terms of this environmental problem, this firefighting problem. Are they justified, you think, in feeling this way?
Well, you know, I don't want to sort of opine on whether, you know, they're justified or not, but what is true here is that at least since 2015, the Bureau of Indian Affairs was aware that this business was operating illegally. They had issued previous trespassing orders against the owners of the facility in 2015 and 2017. And so part of the investigation that the local congressman, Dr. Raul Ruiz, has called for is an investigation into why the agency hadn't previously enforced those orders, because as the congressman said in a very strongly worded letter, none of these fires would have happened, nor an injury to a firefighter would have happened if the agency had enforced those orders previously.
Now, considering that, as you write in your story, that this isn't the first time this fire has burned in this particular area, especially in the last year, it might happen again sometime soon and many times in the future. What have officials said about maybe trying to control this or not letting it happen again?
So the congressman's office has requested a written cleanup plan from the Bureau of Indian Affairs for this particular facility that asks, among other things, how they plan to secure the site from future illegal dumping. And what's also happening as well is the Torres Martinez tribe, which is the tribe in that area. It's one of the least resourced tribes in the valley here. And so they themselves sort of struggle with enforcement. They don't have an EPA office themselves like some other tribes might. And so going forward, the congressman wants to figure out a way that they can in the future more swiftly coordinate between agencies to ensure that response is more swift. Local activists and nonprofits are trying to figure out how they can be more proactive in case there is a future fire in terms of where students can be placed rather than sending them home, where a lot of students live in mobile homes that don't have central air conditioning. So when the South Coast Air Quality Management District issues smoke advisories, for them, sometimes it's not realistic because their parents still have to go work in the fields. And, you know, at home, they don't have central AC, so that makes it tough for them to avoid some of the smoke.
One more thing, Ricardo, mention how that fire is burning right near Desert Mirage High School. Is that high school still open? Are the students still going to school there?
So classes were canceled for a week. 4 days after the fire had started, there was an emergency evacuation at the three campuses there, as well as other nearby schools, because something like 24 students, I think, were sickened by the smoke, and I think about a dozen were hospitalized. And so school was canceled for a week. The EPA and I think there was another agency that came in at the testing of the air, because there was suspicion that perhaps it wasn't just green waste at the facility that had been burning. They thought maybe there was something toxic that was making people sick. Officials have since said that the air wasn't toxic, but nonetheless, the smoke is not healthy to be breathing. Yeah.
Ricardo Lopez, reporter at the Desert Sun. Ricardo, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
All right, once, just one time in my entire life, I sang a song in public. It was at an audition in my late teens when I had Hollywood dreams, and I was asked to sing for a role that might include a song or two. Now, I was terrified, but I got through it, never done it again. But there are plenty of people, actual talented ones, who love sharing their musical gifts with the community. Coming up, we'll hear about some folks in Highland Park who do just that when Take Two continues. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Every night in L.A., there are countless concerts and open mics where performers try to get even just a few minutes of time in the limelight. For local musicians, it can be hard to find their place in such a crowded field. But one group in Highland Park is trying to change that. Take 2 contributor Ari Saperstein has their story.
1, 2, 3, Bell B-G-E.
If 1, 2, 3 bell sounds different than how you learn to count, well, that's because here, with the Herman Park Community Band, everything is a little bit different. Every Saturday morning, musicians gather at a bungalow in the Arroyo Seco Park for something that's one part private lesson.
Try kind of just blowing a little harder, or a little... Okay, cool.
One part songwriting workshop.
We're going to play the pinky finger dance. I should be saying it should be concerto for pinky finger dancer, but there's not going to be the soloist today.
And one part jam session. It's free and open to the public. No sign up or registration required. You just drop in and grab an instrument.
Everybody's welcome. Anybody can play. It's a really open community feel.
That's Monk Turner. He's been playing the bass for 25 years. And what he loves about the community band is that he's able to share his wealth of knowledge with the newcomers in the group.
Everybody's encouraged to play no matter how old you are, no matter what your experience level.
And he means everyone.
My name is Christy Rodehorst, and I'm 79, and I play the flute. And I played all the way through my sophomore year in high school and then let it go.
But when Rodehorst moved to LA last year, she discovered the community band and a reason to take up the flute again.
I realized how special it was. It's just wonderful. I'm 50 years older than most of them, and we all get along, and it's pretty special.
Those decades younger bandmates include drummer Dan Bucott.
So I've been here since like day one, and like, because I would walk my dogs through the park, and then I just heard a sound coming out of the room. And then I just like poked my head in and like, what's going on in here? So just organically, I think that's kind of how the space was designed. Like people just kind of stumble upon it.
In fact, that is exactly what band director Logan Hone hoped would happen.
I was doing it at my house for a little while, but then at a certain point, I wanted it to be more of a public space and not just feel like only friends were invited, you know?
By being an accessible, inclusive group in a quickly changing section of Northeast LA, the community band brings together a truly diverse collection of neighbors who, according to Monk Turner, would likely have not met otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the big city thing, right? We all live so close, but, you know, yeah, I don't know that we would have, honestly. I don't know my neighbors in my building. In Los Angeles, there's not a lot of opportunities to really have a local experience. A lot of folks here are just coming from down the block.
Today, the band is doing a performance, and some of the attendees trickling in are discovering the space for the first time, the same way that the band members did, walking through the park, drawn in by the music. But there's also a few audience members who came specifically to support the musicians.
I have a big fan club. It's my walking buddies, Deanne and Janet. And my daughter, Leslie.
Nice to meet you.
Roadhorse daughter, Leslie Bilderback, says that watching her mom perform feels like a role reversal.
She came to all my concerts when I was a kid, so it's only fair that it's my turn to do it.
Thanks so much for coming, everyone. We're going to get this music started.
A performance, on its face, might sound more formal than the band's vibe. But with this crowd, small, local, filled with friends and family, it still feels intimate. It feels low stakes. And that's something that's important to all the band members.
Yeah, I feel like it's hard to find places to play music that are no pressure.
The community band is a decidedly pressure-free zone. Even during the performance, when mistakes happen, it's all good.
Let's start over that section. Let's start over that section. It goes one, two, three, bop, bop, bop.
But in spite of the low-key environment, the band's newest member, Jiro Matsuki, was still feeling some pre-show jitters.
I was so nervous. I still feel so nervous.
Understandably, since this was his first time playing music live. Like, ever. But come showtime, he's a rock star. The band's 40-minute set flies by, and the performance comes to an end with one last song.
One, two, one. You know what? This one might be a nice little dance party if anyone wants to stand up for this one.
But, of course.
No pressure. One, two, three, four.
And no expectations. It's just neighbors having fun together. That's just how it goes here at the Community Band. Emphasis on the community. For Take Two, I'm Ari Saperstein.
All right, now in closing today, some news we can all feel good about. California has received the best marks in the nation when it comes to protecting the coast. Now, that's according to the latest Surfrider Foundation State of the Beach survey. The California Report's Eric Anderson has more.
California got an A grade for its efforts to protect the state's coastline. The survey looked at sediment management, coastal development, coastal armoring, and sea level rise. Washington State and Oregon got B grades on the West Coast. But nearly half of the states graded around the country got D's or F's. Surfrider's Stephanie Sikich-Quinn says California's good reviews don't mean officials can relax.
This is going to be a continual, perpetual updating of building standards and of sea level rise planning as we have climate change continue and extreme weather events continue.
The higher scoring states had strong policies for coastal protections. Six of the 31 coastal states improved their ranking since the first report was issued in 2017.
That was Eric Anderson of KQED's The California Report. All right, if you missed any part of Take Two and you're thinking, darn it, I wish I'd have heard the whole show, well, we got you covered. Just go wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be, Take Two Show, waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us all over social media. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. Be back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.